listening to Mr. Open Banking, the only podcast dedicated to exploring the open banking movement. Whether you're a financial expert, banking executive, or everyday consumer, open banking affects everyone and will change the way we interact with our money. I'm Eyal Sivan, your host. This episode is brought to you by Ozone API, unlocking the power of open finance all over the world. Open banking is all about putting the consumer at the center. It aims to create a financial system that supports people, that benefits them more than it benefits the banks, that acknowledges the rights we have over how our money is moved and how our data is shared. In some places, they even changed the name to emphasize that very point. In Canada, it's called consumer-driven banking. In Australia, it's called the consumer data right. And in the US, it's called personal financial data rights. Underlying open banking is an important assumption that if you give the consumer all the information about what data is held on them and all the control over how that data is shared, that they will be better off, that they will do the right things with that information and control, things that are good for them. But is that actually so? Behavioral economics says that perhaps the answer is no. Rising into prominence in the 90s and 2000s, behavioral economics combines insights from psychology and economics to understand how people actually make decisions, rather than assuming they always behave rationally. It looks at the cognitive biases, emotions, and social factors that influence decision-making and explores why people sometimes act against their best interests. Our distinguished guest is one of the leading experts in this burgeoning field, and he is particularly interested in how people manage their money and why they do it so badly. As open banking puts in place the ability to manage not only our money, but also our data, the insights of behavioral economics are key to ensuring these efforts are worthwhile. After all, the goal is not just to build a system that gives us more information and control, but to make sure that that system helps us in making better decisions. Dan Ariely is a professor, scientist, best-selling author, and self-styled experimentalist. He is the James B. Duke Professor of Behavioral Economics at Duke University, where he co-founded the Center for Advanced Hindsight. Prior to Duke, Dan was the Alfred P. Sloan Professor of Behavioral Economics at MIT, where he still holds an appointment at the MIT Media Lab as head of the Irrationality Research Group. Dan is the author of three New York Times best-selling books, Predictably Irrational, The Upside of Irrationality, and The Honest Truth About Dishonesty. He has also published Irrationally Yours, based on his Wall Street Journal column, and Payoff, based on his TED Talks, which have been viewed more than 27 million times. His work has been featured in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, and elsewhere. Outside of Duke, Dan's resume includes working with the likes of Google and Apple, as well as several governments, including those of the US, Canada, and Australia. Through his work, Dan questions the forces that influence human behavior, helping us understand why we think and behave the way we do, and encouraging us to make better mistakes. Dan, it's an honor to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, and lovely to be with you, and looking forward to our discussion.
Let's begin. What is behavioral economics?
I think that for me, there's kind of two parts for this answer. The first one is that it stands in contradiction to standard economics. So standard economics assumes that people are perfectly rational. They always take all the information into account and make the best possible decisions, always, always, always. And behavioral economics doesn't have any axiomatic assumptions. It doesn't assume that people are making the right decision or the wrong decision. It's empirically driven. So it says, let's put people in different situations and see how they decide. And when you do that, you find out very often that people don't make rational decisions. So that's the first part. But the second part that is perhaps more important is the question of how do we design the world? And behavioral economics basically saying, we need to design the world in a way that is compatible with human nature. We need to design cars that are compatible with human nature. We need to design information technology in a way that is compatible with human nature. When we go around to design policies for schools and healthcare and cars and prison sentences, all of those things, we have to take human nature into account. So it's both a different description of human behavior, that's the first part, and a different prescriptive approach to what do we do with this information.
How can we apply the concepts of behavioral economics to help people make better choices with their money?
The sad realization from social science in general is that it's very, very hard to change people. The good news is that it's relatively easier to change people's environments. And if you think about money, money is really the domain that is the easiest to change behavior because money is now digital. Imagine that I wanted to change how you eat. I would have to change supermarkets. I would have to change restaurants. I would have to change your kitchen. I would have to change lots of things. With money, because a lot of it is digital, it's much easier to think about how do we change the environment and get people to behave in better ways. So how do we do it? What kind of things do we have in mind that would get people to act in a better way? And to think about this, we really need to understand what is money all about. Money is really about opportunity cost. The amazing thing about money, and money is really one of the most important inventions of society, is that if we spend a dollar on one thing, we can't spend it on something else. Money can be exchanged with lots of things, but it also means that if we spend money on one thing, like coffee, we have less money for something else. But the reality is that it's very hard for us to think about opportunity cost. It's hard for us to think about opportunity cost when we buy cars, and it's hard for us to think about opportunity cost when we buy coffee. If we understand that one of the challenges of thinking correctly about money is about opportunity cost, then we say, can we create something that would make opportunity cost more salient, easier for people to process? So think about the comparison between credit cards and prepaid debit cards. If we come to people and we say, give me whatever you want to spend this month. And let's say people say $2,000. They say, okay, go ahead, spend on your credit card. Let's see at the end of the month what you get. And people dramatically overspend. Condition number two, we do the same thing, but we don't tell people, let us track your credit card. We say, why don't you use a prepaid debit card and put that amount of money that you want to spend, $2,000, on this prepaid debit card? Now, you can always go and add more to it, but put $2,000 to start with, whatever you want your spending budget to be. What happens? People still overshoot, but not by as much. When we have a credit card, we just go up and up and up and up. When we have a prepaid debit card with $2,000, it gets to zero and people think about it more carefully. Now, with the prepaid debit card, what you see is that people spend way too much in the beginning and then they run out. So what if we give them a prepaid debit card, not with $2,000 per month, but with $500 per week? Turns out that's even better. It turns out that's even more compatible with their human thinking. When you start the month and you say, oh my goodness, I have $2,000, you feel rich and you overspend. When you start the week with $500, you feel less rich and you don't spend as much. But one more nuance. We tried to start this prepaid debit card on Monday versus on Friday. Which approach is better? It turns out the Monday approach is better. Why? Because if we load the money on Friday, people feel rich on the weekend and then they spend a lot. If we load it on Monday, people savor. They try to keep money for the weekend. And if they fail, the weekend is a good to scale up and down. If we think carefully about the tools that would help people, we can help people make better decisions. Prepaid debit is better than credit. Weekly is better than monthly. And weekly that starts on Monday is better than weekly that starts on Friday. There are two general types of categories of things we could do with money. We could do things that are visible, and we could do things that are invisible. In the visible category, we could buy our kids a piece of fruit or candy or bicycle or whatever. In the invisible category, we could put more money in savings, buy insurance, pay down debt. And in general, the visible category is much more motivating than the invisible category. If you go and buy a piece of fruit, your kids might say thank you. If you go and you put more money in their college savings account, or you prepaid debt, or you do all kind of things, nobody will say thank you, maybe 30 years from now. And we understood that one of the first thing we need to do is we need to make this invisible category more visible if we want it to compete with the visible category. When you understand human nature, you basically think also about how do we design our money systems in a way that is more compatible with our psychology.
You mention visible and invisible. What about for the money itself? Money has increasingly become more invisible as it's become digital. Does this make it easier or more difficult to promote positive behaviors?
In general, when we see money, we think about it. And when we don't see it, we don't think about it. So the movement from physical money to digital had some advantage in terms of control, but it has some disadvantages in the way that technology has developed. So imagine that you pay with one of those digital technologies, Apple Pay, Google Pay, you put your fingerprint, maybe you wink at some display. All of that is making you think less about money. And we said already that money is all about opportunity cost. When you spend something, you should be thinking very carefully about what it is that you're giving up. But if the experience doesn't even penetrate your thinking that much, then you're certainly even further away from thinking about opportunity cost. So if I have an envelope with $100, and that's all the money that I have to spend this week, every amount I spend, I see what's left. Now, there could be a digital equivalent to that, right? I don't think it's just physical. But the way we as a society have done digital currency is to get people to think less and less about opportunity cost, to pay less and less attention to it. This is why we're so surprised at the end of the month when we get our credit card bill, because we haven't paid attention as much. So it's not so much about digital versus physical. It's about the choices society has made, and the payment companies specifically, has been to make payment less thoughtful rather than more thoughtful. Like you could imagine that if we got together, we could make digital payment even more thoughtful. You basically are about to spend something in a digital currency, like a new shirt for $80. And before you pay, a screen pops and say, hey, this $80, which budget is it coming from? It's not digital versus not. It's that we do digital and we have done lots of things. The payment companies have done lots of things for people to pay very little attention to spending, therefore increasing spending and decreasing thinking.
Even though digital money might compel us to think about the consequences of spending less, it is, as a system, more easily changed than one based on physical cash.
Absolutely. I think it's not so much about digital versus physical. I can imagine that digital has kind of a huge range. Let's just assume that we're measuring it in seconds of thinking. The moment we move to digital money, the range is under our control. We can have payment methods that get people to pay and not even think about themselves as paying. And there are payment methods that can get people to think a lot about paying. So the point is, it's not about digital. Digital gives us a larger range. We could get money to be very unthoughtful, or we could make it to be very thoughtful. It is our choice as the people who are designing the payment methods.
These decisions around how to present the choices, how to present the impact of the choices, is that what is meant by choice architecture?
Absolutely. So choice architecture is the idea that the environment really matters, that the way we think and the decision that are easier is shaped by the environment. And you put the same people in the same mindset in different environments and you'll get very different choices. You put the same person with cash and credit card, they'll act very differently. So the environment really matters. On one hand, it says that we need to be very careful about the design of the environment. On the other hand, it means that if the environment is not designed for our benefit, we can make tons of mistakes. And right now, a lot of the environments are not designed well. They're not designed for our benefit. And one metaphor for this is to think about the car. The car is generally an environment that is designed with an eye toward human limitation. In fact, every year, cars get better. How do cars get better? They get better by assuming new heights of human inability to drive. Right? When cars started, they said, okay, here's a car. They said, okay, we really need anti-lock brakes and we really need seat belts and we need side mirrors and we need rear view mirror and then we need lights on the mirrors and we need sensors and we need to change the steering wheel. We need. Every year, we make cars more compatible with our mediocre ability to drive. Our ability to spend money correctly, our ability to make good decisions about money is not much better than our ability to drive. But the systems that we're designing are not taking our human limitation into account and working with them to make us better financial decision makers. They're mostly working against us to make us worse financial decision makers and make us spend more money in a less thoughtful way. It's as if cars would have been created every year with an eye toward getting us to make worse and worse driving decisions.
And crucially, it seems like changing these behaviors can often be done by altering relatively small factors as opposed to big ones. What are behavioral nudges?
So behavioral nudges is the idea that there's tiny things that you could do that get people to act or think differently. What is the biggest factor that gets people to save for retirement in the US? It turns out it's the default rate of their 401k. Companies that have 3% is the default rate. People basically save 3%. Companies that have 6% save 6% and so on. Whatever the default is, that's what people basically use. You know, you come to a new job, you have lots of paperwork to go through. One of the pieces of paper that you have to go through is to decide how much to save for retirement, what percentage. Very tough decision, very complex. What happened? People just adopt the default. But think about this form that says, where do you want your salary deposited? That form is always putting 100% of our salary, whatever is left after retirement, into checking. Why don't we have another line that says, why don't you put 10% into savings? But we basically say, put everything into checking, and later on, go and hunt for another form that would put some of that money into savings. And of course, most people don't do it. So if we could create the right environment where some of your money would move into checking, some would move into savings, a higher amount would move into retirement fund, we could get people to start with much better footing than get everybody to figure out for themselves what is the right thing to do and hope that they will pay attention to it and improve it over time and increase it and so on.
You often break these nudges into friction and motivation. What are some of the ways these two techniques can be applied to financial services?
So when we analyze behavioral change, we basically do exactly what you suggested. We said, let's look at the current behavior of people and let's compare it to what we think will be an ideal behavior. And if the two are not the same, then we say, okay, let's figure out what's standing between the current behavior and the ideal behavior. And then we break it into two components, friction and fuel, or friction and motivation. And friction is basically asking the question, what is it about the current system that is holding people back? What is between people and good behavior? So for example, and we say people don't save enough, we say, well, one friction is people have to find out the form to put some money into savings. And then another friction is people have to figure out what is the right amount for them to save. And then people have to fill in the form. And sometimes people need to get their spouse to sign it and so on. So all of those things are friction, things that are standing between us and good behavior, filling a form, finding a form, adding information, taking an action, finding out something. All of those things we call friction. And the easiest thing to do is to look at the gap between the current behavior and ideal behavior and say, what is currently standing in the line between people and good behavior? Then the next thing to do is to say, and what motivation can we add to the mix? Right? So what does that mean? We talked in the section about making the invisible visible. You know, most breadwinners don't feel sufficiently appreciated. And when they do things that are visible, somebody might smile at them or say thank you. But when they do invisible things, nobody says thank you. What if we made the invisible visible? And now somebody could say thank you even for these hidden activities like paying down debt, buying insurance, and savings. The fuel part, the motivation part, is to say, what other motivations can we add? Can we make people feel that they're doing the right thing? Can we get them to feel that they are learning something? Can we get them to feel that they're taking care of their family? Can we get them to feel that they're in control, that they're a smarter money manager? Can we get people to feel appreciated? Think about all the things that get people to write poetry and climb mountains and write books and do startups, all the things that get people to feel deeply, deeply motivated. Which one of those can we add to the mix and thereby get activities that are not that much fun to be more fun?
Money has become digital, which, as Dan explains, is something of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, digital money is much less visible than physical money. That means we often think much less about how we spend it, and we don't notice when it starts to run out. Banks and payment companies don't seem to think this is a problem to solve, even if we do. On the other hand, digital money is much easier to change and improve than physical money. the range of options is nearly unlimited, enabling us to create a money system more in line with the way we think. A system that warns us when we make bad decisions and encourages us when we make good ones. A system truly built with the consumer at the center. For those banks and fintechs brave enough to do so. But is that the system that is actually being put in place today? That's where Dan and I pick things up. As we explore the difference between friction and motivation, let's try and use digital banking, digital money, our interaction with data as a kind of lens. Your thoughts on terms and conditions as it applies to financial products or just as well to software. That can be considered friction, but it's necessary, isn't it? What role does that play in motivating behavior?
Okay, so I think that currently the way we do terms and conditions is basically immoral. These are things that are written in legalese. They come at people not at the right time. People certainly don't read them. They're certainly not informed. Every time people sign something that they clearly are not reading and is clearly not designed for them to read and it's clearly not designed for them to understand, people are trusting that institution a little bit less, but in general, they trust financial institution a little bit less. What are these people doing to me? They're clearly doing something that I can't understand. I don't have the time. I don't have the capacity. I don't have the tool. They're not interested in me understanding it. Clearly, there's some legal issue here that they just want to be covered in case something bad will happen. What? I don't know. So I think it's kind of a kabuki theater of pretending to sign informed consent, but it's not really signing an informed consent. And in fact, I think it's eroding trust in the system, which is incredibly important. If it was me, by the way, so I would say, look, we understand that your time is valuable. And we understand that these documents need to be written in complex language because they try to cover lots of things. So rather than having our lawyers draft them, what we have done, this is in my imaginary world, is we have contracted 250 people of your peers. Here's the demographics and the age and the profession and so on. And we paid them to become your representative on this informed consent. And we went over this with them line by line and explained it very, very carefully to them. And they wanted some changes and we made these changes. And eventually these 250 people of your peer have approved this approach. That I think would go a long way because now you're saying it's not me, the bank and my lawyers who are drafting all kinds of things to try and get out of all kinds of obligation. It says, we've actually spent a lot of time with people to explain and work with them about a version that would be good for everybody. And this, I think, would not erode the trust. I think it would actually increase the trust people have in financial institutions.
The notion of the citizen committee, quite different than what we have today. What is rational ignorance?
Yes. Rational ignorance is the idea that there are lots of topics that to understand them well would require a lot of effort and I can't really do much about it. Let's say I want to join this banking system and it's a 20-page document and I can spend 20 hours, and maybe I can pay a lawyer to look at it. But at the end of the day, I need to use this bank. So what am I going to do? Rational ignorance is basically saying, if I educate myself on this topic, I can't really make a different decision. Let me not educate myself and I remain ignorant because it's not worth the cost of time. And there's lots of things like that. And this is why I like this version of citizen committees, or basically saying, It is crazy to expect every one of the bank's customer to spend the necessary 10 hours to read this. But it's not crazy to get the bank to approach 250 people randomly selected from the bank's customers, let's say, and spend time with them and say, look, you guys are responsible for everybody else. Let's go over it. Ask us questions, clarification. We're here for you. Let's do this process. But of course, if the bank is giving me a legal document that I know was written by their lawyers, I don't think it's good for me, right? I think, okay, there's a power differential here. They know a lot. They are responsible. They're writing something. I hope I'll never have to use this, but I don't think it's written with me in mind. I don't think it's written for my benefit. And therefore, I think that there's all kinds of things that if they happen, the bank will not pay me back. I will get screwed over. There are all kinds of things that I worry about it, which, by the way, is not good for the bank, for this specific bank, but it's also not good for the banking as a whole.
In an effort to build a bridge from friction to motivation, let's talk about this idea that providing people lots of data, lots of information about their money, about their data sharing, about their habits, about their health, fundamentally helps them make better decisions. Is that in fact true? Do those dashboards and so on act as motivation or as friction?
So there's very little evidence that giving people more information is improving decision-making. Think about the quantified self-movement. I too have one of those devices that measure my walking and sleep and all kinds of things like that. 30 years ago, if somebody says one day there'll be a quantified self-movement and people would measure movement and eating and sleeping and so on, what do you think would happen to the obesity epidemic? And we would have said, oh, it would have been over. If people only knew what their bodies were doing, there will be the zero obesity epidemic. Everybody will move and sleep and everything will be solved. Of course, nothing like this happened. If you look at large-scale correlations between adoption of these watches and rings and so on, and improvement in lifestyle, there's basically no relationship between them. Or another example, every year in the U.S., we collectively spend between $700 and $800 million on different training programs for financial literacy. $700 to $800 million on financial literacy. That's a lot of money. What is the outcome? Well, turns out that people remember much of the things that they learned in those classes, short classes, long classes. People remember, good news. But do people act differently? And the answer is basically no. There's one paper with meta-analysis that looked at these effects. And they found that the improvement in financial behavior, saving, budgeting, and so on, is very, very close to zero. And it's because the link between knowing something and acting in a different way is very tenuous. It's not a problem of knowledge, it's a problem of temptation. You teach people something about financial literacy, and then you send them to the mall with 6 credit cards. And lots of for sale signs and smells of fresh baked cookies. You know, what is going to win? This idea that people would know something and will apply it correctly all the time is very, very far-fetched. This is why we need better tools. We can't just rely on people doing the right thing by themselves all the time. When it comes to money, providing dashboards has very tenuous relationship with making better decisions. It's just not effective. On the other hand, doing better financial spending tools, while it is more difficult, has much more potential of being successful.
Let's talk about the motivation side. How can we get people excited about savings?
So we mentioned this idea of feeling appreciated as one good thing. But in life, there are a lot of things where we are looking for feeling of control. And we're looking for all kinds of places to get this feeling of control. In the motivation world, you could say, can we get people to enjoy feeling control by spending better? Could you get people to experiment with spending less and feeling better? We're just not that good in figuring out the relationship between spending money and happiness. Let's try and help figure out which one are the things you bought in the last month that you regret. Let's try to find out the things that you haven't bought that might make you happier. Eliminate the things that we overspend and don't get much happiness, and maximize the things that do. Let's go on a journey that would maximize the relationship between spending and happiness.
When it comes to motivation, what role does paternalism play? To what extent is it the responsibility of the system, let's say the financial system, to directly tell people what the system thinks is best?
So, you know, we have these two very different terms. One is paternalism. In the US, it's considered a bad word, paternalism. And the other one is responsibility, which we think of it as a good term. But I think in many cases, they are the same. In terms of money, if you think that every person could figure out by themselves what is the best way to spend money and what are the things that are actually they're spending lots of money on and are not giving them a lot of happiness, if you think that people can figure out how to not fight about money, how to raise their kids with a good money approach, if you think that people are capable of figuring out all of these complex things, you're wrong. These are really tough things. It's really tough to figure out how much do we enjoy wine compared to the opera, and how much we should spend on housing, and how to trade off distance from work, from size of apartment, of size of a house, and how much we should put into our kids' college savings account, and is allowance a good idea or not a good idea? It's almost like we're telling everybody, you go ahead and figure it out. Money runs so many areas of our lives. Now, you can call it paternalism, but I think they have the obligation to study those things and to give people a plan. Now, is it ideal? No. But is it better than no plan? Absolutely. We use the term paternalism, but I think we should use the term responsibility. And I think that the people who run our money systems have a responsibility to tell us what are better and worse ways to run money and how to avoid some of the traps. And it becomes particularly important, like if you ask me, when do I promote more paternalism? I think more paternalism is called when there's a huge asymmetry of information, when I as the financial institution can know a lot and you as the individual can't, when the decisions are big and important, and when there's no way back. If you try to figure out what is the right amount to save for retirement, that's a big decision. And when you get to age 65, if you didn't make the right decision, it's too late. You can't go back and change it. So as decisions get bigger, as asymmetry of information becomes bigger, as it's harder to figure out for each individual for themselves, and when there's no way back, if you made a mistake, I think those environments call for paternalism or responsibility. How do you get people to spend more money on the things that bring them happiness and spend less on the things that don't? That's not an easy task, but that should be the responsibility of the financial institutions.
Let's shift gears. When it comes to open banking, there are really two areas in regards to human behavior that it addresses. One is the management of money, and the other is the management of personal data. Money is relatively well understood. The notion of data sharing is not. how do you see the notions of behavioral economics applying to this burgeoning world of data sharing?
People treat information as if it's theirs. But you can think about taxes. And you say, you know, with taxes, I understand that about half of what I make goes to the government. It goes to pay for public things that we all consume together. And I'm fine with it. I think that's what being a citizen means, that I share my income with other people. I think that part of being a citizen in the world could be that I benefit from other people's information, and I am going to give other people the benefit from my information. If my information can help figure out things for society, I'm very much in favor of it. I think it's about being a good citizen. Now, we don't want people to be abused, but I think people should have some obligation to share it.
Do you think we should be responsible for protecting and managing our personal data? Or should the systems, like banks or technology companies or governments, be responsible instead?
So I don't think people should be responsible for their own data for two reasons. First of all, I don't think it's reasonable to expect people to be responsible for much. We can all admit how often we lose passwords. And to basically say you have a system that is just your responsibility, I think is just ignores human nature. So I think we shouldn't have systems that depend on all individuals to make things right. But the second thing is that if we make a system that depends on individual, we're going to discriminate against the people who are the most vulnerable. Think about it. Who are the people that are least likely to have the ability to write their passwords, that will have the least ability to understand how to manage this, that have the least ability to control it? It's the people who are in the most need. So I think it's not just a bad idea on average. It's also a particularly bad idea for the people who are the most vulnerable. Those are the people who make the most mistakes, be the most abused. And we certainly don't want to create a system like this. So for both of those reasons, the average and the most vulnerable, I think it's the systems that need to be responsible and not the individual.
If you lean more paternalistic, then who is the parent when it comes to data sharing? Is it the technology companies, the government, or the banks, or someone else?
I think it needs to be somebody else. So I really love the idea of citizen committees, and I love the idea of science. So I think that in these questions of how to handle this, it certainly should not be the financial institution and their lawyers. I don't think it should just be the government. I think it's basically people of our peer, given enough time to think about the question carefully and then to sketch out what is the right approach. So I would certainly hope that there would be a council for privacy, and I would hope that they would run citizen committees with all the support and help, but eventually it would be us as people who would decide what are we willing to accept and reject. To do that, we need to create a body of people who represent us, the people, and help us figure out what are the right level of rules and what are the exceptions and what are the ramifications and so on.
So even though our systems should be built to take care of us automatically, the systems themselves should be designed by us, the people.
So it's a very, very good point. You know, I've talked a lot about human failure. And indeed, we fail all the time. Left to our own accord financially, we would make lots of mistakes. Our power comes from designing our environment. It's not that we're all able to make good decisions all the time. is that from time to time, we're able to say, we are now designing a system and we're going to design this system with tremendous care. And then we're going to become at the mercy of that system. So imagine that you and I design an eating system right now. We designed a system that would cook for us for the next year. You know, what food would be purchased and what food would be made and so on. And we designed that system. We would be healthier at the end of the year. Now, it doesn't mean that every time we go to a restaurant, we make good decisions. Of course we don't. But if we designed a system, we could create a system that would make it much more likely. I think that human freedom is not in making all of our decisions from scratch every time, because then we will fail a lot. Our well-being, future, and freedom is in designing systems that will make it much more likely that we will make good decisions in the future. So that I think we can do. And I think we can do it for money, and I think we can do it for security of information and for information sharing.
We shape our tools, and then our tools shape us.
Exactly.
Dan, where can our guests find out more about you and the work you're doing?
The best place is my website, danarielly.com, danarielly.com. But I have two other websites that I recently started. One is called the Center for Advanced Bureaucracy. You can see that. And the other one is called The Life We Should Live. And in this website, I'm trying to basically try to figure out what we can do to make the last chapter of life better. So my main website, the Center for Advanced Bureaucracy, and this new website called The Life We Should Live.
Dan, thank you so much for a wonderful conversation. It's been an honor having you on the show.
Thank you so much. And looking forward to you inviting me another time.
The term free lunch holds a special place in economics. In classical economics, free lunch refers to the idea that there are no truly cost-free opportunities. All resources are scarce, and every decision involves trade-offs or opportunity cost. But in behavioral economics, while the core idea remains, the focus shifts to how people perceive these costs. In his celebrated book, Predictably Irrational, Dan describes a free lunch as the idea that there are tools, methods, and policies that can help all of us make better decisions. One experiment after another shows that providing people with more information and control does not automatically lead to better decisions. The link between knowing something and acting differently is very tenuous indeed. So when those crafting open banking make the assumption that giving people more control over their money and their data will naturally lead to better outcomes, they may want to think again. The environment in which such control is given matters more than the control itself. And the responsibility to build that environment in a way that genuinely benefits the consumer lies with all of us. To build open banking in a way that works for everyone, banks, fintechs, regulators, and citizens alike will have to work together to create an environment based on how we actually are, rather than the way we imagine ourselves to be. Predictably Irrational closes with the following line: businesses and policymakers could revise their thinking and consider how to design their policies and products so as to provide free lunches. In other words, to design a financial system that helps all of us make better decisions. Thanks for listening to Mr. Open Banking, the podcast that explores the ongoing evolution of open banking and its impact on our lives. Make no mistake, the rise of open banking is going to change financial services forever, and we will be covering that story every step of the way. This is your host, A.L. Savan. Until next time. This episode of Mr. Open Banking was made possible by Ozone API, providers of the only API platform that supports every open banking standard in the world, unlocking the power of open finance. To learn more, visit ozoneapi.com.